It's officially 2026, and my New Year's resolution is to prioritize high-quality pieces in my wardrobe. Thanks to Quince, I can already check that off my list. I'm already planning outfits around my new cotton Oxford shirt. It's such a classic, timeless piece that I know I'll be rewearing all year. Need more than just a wardrobe update? Quince has tons of options for the home as well. Maya has had the same dinnerware since college and has finally decided it's time for a refresh, starting with a gorgeous set of ceramic cake plates. Refresh your wardrobe with Quince. Don't wait. Go to quince.com/rehash for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/rehash to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/rehash.
This new season of Love Island is so friggin' good.
I only saw one episode, but I'm taking your word for it. I'm gonna invest some time into it. I'm gonna do it.
Nice. Yeah, listen up. I've broken down what exactly is good about it. And all I've got to say is last season, it was All-Stars season. So it was like all these people who already knew each other, a bunch of them had already dated. They're way too versed in how to be influencers. And so it was like the most boring, tame season I've ever seen, apart from like a couple unhinged people. But this season, it's like the people are kind of, for lack of better words, a little bit trashy. I don't know if the psych evaluations worked on them or if they skipped right through it because they are emotionally volatile. They are duplicitous.
Maybe they changed the psych evaluations for the worse.
Maybe. I've talked a lot about how gender segregated it used to be, where like it started becoming where like all the girls would sit on one side of the place and all the boys would sit on the other, and they do all these ritualistic things, like the boys would make them coffee, or like they have this thing called the hideaway where people can go and like have alone time, quote unquote, which used to be used for people to just like have sex at any time of day, but instead became this thing where like you have to earn the hideaway. And then it became this like ritualistic thing where they do this weird bedding ceremony and they like dress up in costumes and the girls would parade around the makeup room.
It's so weird now. Yeah, they just put them in like lingerie and they're like,
they don't have sex.
And then they're like, okay, time for a cuddle.
And it really is, I'm like, show me to me, please, Rachel. I want to see you have sex. I want to see someone having sex in the hideaway. And no, I've been robbed of that for seasons and seasons. And now they've made the hideaway available 24/7. So, and the most fun caveat of it is that you cannot take the person you're coupled up with into the hideaway. It has to be someone you are not coupled up with. So the hideaway is just a chamber of betrayal.
The difficult thing about talking about Love Island, especially for something that will not be released for weeks, is that that show moves at such an accelerated speed.
Oh, true.
That, like, by the time this episode comes out, what we're saying could be completely irrelevant or off, but it's a good start.
But you guys can have some amazing irony and you can laugh at me and how naive I am. And maybe the season becomes absolute shit.
Yeah, we'll check back in.
Yeah. Update from the future, the season did become absolute shit.
Maybe it's a testament to a good summer if there's a good season of Love Island on.
What are we calling this summer again? Is it just Brat Summer?
I don't know. It was like Challenger Summer, Brat Summer. Just have a summer.
What does Brat Summer mean in essence? Like, what is it evoking?
Smoking is back in. Not washing your hair. Wearing like a wife beater with no bra.
That's me every day.
Big sunglasses.
I feel like my essence has been stolen.
Yeah, actually, Charlie XCX ripped off her entire vibe.
Charlie XCX heard about my essence, and she said, "I'm gonna suck that out of you. I'm gonna suck that out of you and turn it into a neon green something or other."
Hell yeah!
The marketing campaign for Brat is like absolute genius.
Oh my god, I saw a reel by like Warner Music Canada or something, or maybe not, some Canadian music thing, and they just posted a video of the GO train, which, and if you live in Ontario, the GO train is a train that takes you places around the GTA and Ontario, and it's green, and they were like, the Brat marketing has gone out of control, and it was just our green train.
Oh yeah,
it's like everyone's jumping on the bandwagon.
Everyone's jumping on the GO train.
Except you know who hasn't yet, and it's beyond me, and I'm thinking there must be some kind of legal trademarking stuff. Brats, like Bratz the dolls, they jump on every kind of trend for the exact demographic that would be listening to Brat, and yet they've done no post to commemorate Brat.
Maybe they're plotting a damning lawsuit against Charli XCX.
I think there has to be something going on here, because otherwise they would have immediately posted like a Brat stall that was Brat Charli XCX.
I know, because they love working with different IP and making it Brat.
Well, they always do it, and it's always the specific kind of stuff that would appeal to the people who are bumping Brat.
Well, again, this episode is pre-recorded, so maybe something will change down the line.
I can't wait.
Can't wait.
I'm at the edge of my seat.
I'm Maya.
And I'm Hannah.
And this is Rehash, a podcast about the internet phenomena that strike a nerve in our culture, only to be quickly forgotten, but we think are due for a revisiting. This season is about when art meets the internet. Is the sun rising on a new creative era, or did it set before it even began? If you like our show and you want to hear more from us, you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/rehashpodcast, where we've got bonus episodes, weekly mini episodes, and early access to our regular programming. And if you don't want to join the Patreon, feel free to rate and review us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, because that hella helps us out. Yeah.
Summer Brat.
So for this episode, I want to talk about that essay that Emily Ratajkowski wrote for Vulture back in 2020 called Buying Myself Back. I'm sure you have all heard about it at this point. It was very widely talked about at the time it came out. And I think it raises many crucial questions about photography as an art form and kind of like where it's headed, or at least it gets the ball rolling on those questions. For those of you who, we say this in every episode, for those of you who live under a rock.
Losers.
Emily Ratajkowski, or Emrata, as I will be referring to her, I think, for most of the episode.
And as we will be referring to her for her life.
Is one of the most popular models of our time. She came to prominence back in 2013 when she appeared topless in Robin Thicke's Blurred Lines music video. But for real heads, her first notable public appearance was as Gibby's girlfriend on iCarly.
Iconic.
Since then, she's played a role in David Fincher's Gone Girl, she's been on the covers of Vogue and Sports Illustrated, and in 2021, she released a best-selling book called My Body, which is something of like a spiritual follow-up to the Vulture piece. Did you read the Vulture essay, Hannah?
I did at the time it came out. It's been a few years, but I do remember it was a huge deal when it was released.
And do you remember what it was about, generally?
Yeah, it was recounting her experience, I believe, with like an early photo shoot she had done, like when she was quite young, that had turned into like a very sinister situation with a photographer. And then I believe those photographs ended up becoming resold or repackaged in some way, and it for like millions of dollars. And just the experience of being able to buy back, I think, one of the images of her. Is that?
You're like... Okay. Half right.
It's been a while since I read it.
Yeah, so I guess I'll just be more specific about it. But yeah, so in the essay, she brings up three major instances in her career in which her agency as the subject of a photo was compromised. The first is when she reposted a paparazzi image of herself onto Instagram, holding a massive bouquet of flowers in front of her face. She was subsequently slapped with an $150,000 lawsuit by the paparazzo who took the photo.
What?
Yeah. If there's one thing about paparazzos, they're...
Shameless.
The second is when she and her boyfriend at the time came upon an exhibition by a photographer named Richard Prince, where he had blown up a number of images from other people's Instagrams and put them on display, one of them being Emily. And the third, and this is the one you were talking about, which is definitely the most controversial, I think it made the most headlines from this piece, was when the photographer Jonathan Leader sexually assaulted a very young Emily, I believe she was 20, after a photo shoot at his house. And then later, after she got famous, published a book of nude images without her consent that he had taken of her that night, which weren't taken for the purpose of the project they were working on together. So like, the night started out with him asking her to strip into lingerie, which is something she had already been doing. So she was like, for sure, did that. And then he was like, why don't you take your clothes off? And that's when he started taking photos of her nude, but the nude photos weren't what he was commissioned to do. Right. They were just like him being artistic, quote unquote.
Love.
And so he has, yeah, essentially profited from these photos that she thought he wouldn't share.
Right.
There's obviously starkly different levels of severity and like harm across these instances, but I actually think Emily does like a really good job of weaving this theme of agency between them. And she raises like really fascinating questions about consent and ownership. Jonathan Leder has like outright denied the sexual assault allegations, but this man's entire fucking public persona and the way he's spoken about Emily, it's just like so vile in the way that he's just justified at exploiting her nudes for his own gain. Like, it just does not make a very good case for him. Like, he's a little rat man.
I mean, yeah, I can imagine.
Or just like an old-fashioned misogynist, like true blue misogyny. I don't know. I personally just have so much trouble buying these guys who like exclusively take softcore like images of hot skinny women as artists.
Oh, for sure. It's like, really, what was beckoning you to your art form? Like, what was it, kind of like a God-given like passion that you're being driven by, or are you just a horny like guy who couldn't be around these women otherwise?
Well, yeah, they really contributed to what I will again say in hyperbole is my feeling that photography is dead, because I'm like, oh, I'm sorry, you're a photographer and you get paid to do this because you take images of hot naked girls. Like, it's ugh.
what do we have a name for those guys that will just like DM girls on Instagram and be like, hey, do you want to like shoot sometime?
Is there a name for it?
I don't know. I feel like we had a shorthand for it.
Reply guy?
No. I think there's just guys that are like fancy themselves photographers, but yeah, just want to take pictures of like hot girls. And it's like your lack of artistry you think is being made up for by exhibiting something that is beautiful, perhaps.
Oh, totally. Yeah, it's like maybe this girl's just beautiful and that's why your photo is good,
and like you don't have to really do much.
Oh yeah, especially if it's like she's naked. It's yeah. Like, well yeah, the photo's gonna do numbers.
Yeah,
inherently.
It's going to be like she's compelling putting it to look at because it's Emily Ratajkowski naked.
Yeah, I'm like, you should thank her for looking like that. So the Jonathan Leder situation has been very widely publicized. And so for the purposes of this season and like the theme that we're going for, I actually want to focus this episode on Emily's battle with Richard Prince. Because unlike the Jonathan Leder thing, which is so obvious in who is exploiting who and who is robbed of agency, I think Richard Prince's series actually kind of intentionally draws attention to some serious dilemmas that photography is facing when it comes to social media. And his use of Emily's photo, it makes you feel gross and it makes you feel icky, but I do think that it's a bit more of a moral gray area that I think would just be interesting to unpack in this episode. So essentially, back in 2014, Emily and her boyfriend at the time were told by a gallerist friend that they might want to check out an upcoming exhibition that the friend was doing, which was called Instagram Paintings by Richard Prince, who is a very well-known photographer. Like, he's been in the industry for decades. So she and her boyfriend went to the show and realized that rather than being paintings in the traditional sense, Richard Prince had essentially blown up images from Instagram and put them onto canvas. And two of them were of Emily. One was a black and white nude photo of her that had been taken for a magazine cover, and the other was a photo used for her first appearance in Sports Illustrated. And Emily notes that everyone at the time, including her boyfriend, told her that it was an honor to be featured in a Richard Prince series. Immediately, Emily's boyfriend was like, let's buy this painting. Let's put up money for it. It was like $80,000. And she talks about how weird it felt. And this is kind of what you were talking about, but I think you had mentioned it in relation to the Jonathan Leder photos, but it was actually in relation to the Richard Prince thing. She talks about how weird it felt having to spend a bunch of money on what is literally an image of herself. So like buying herself back. Although I kind of want to pause and ask you what you think of Emily posing this as a tug and war of ownership between her and Richard Prince when the image was actually taken by another photographer altogether. Like, I just want to ask or like think about how much ownership you think like a model has over a photo that's been taken for a publication.
Well, I was going to say, I think part of being a model is basically being kind of a blank slate, that you're being used in these contexts, but it's like for either like, yeah, a brand or an artist. Like, that's sort of your job as a model. So I do think there's a difference between something being taken for a magazine versus something you've taken yourself, or like your friend has taken for you, even like something that's taken by a photographer for their own like artistic work versus a photographer for the sake of like selling Sports Illustrated. I do think they're different things. I can only imagine as a model there being this sort of back and forth in your head about how you regard your own autonomy and like your ownership of yourself and your image, because you're so constantly loaning it out to different people and to different entities for their like for their purposes. Mm-hmm. But it is just part of the trade. I think it's like, I'm sure something she's had to kind of work through and understand, but I don't necessarily think you can equate the two things.
Yeah, I think it's that whole dilemma of being the muse, being perceived and being like rendered and being gazed upon by the person doing it. But then, yeah, you were part of the finished product. You are the icon of the finished product. So it's like so hard to reckon with that. But yeah, it's so much of the job of modeling. That is the entire point of it, essentially.
Because modeling is a form of labor. Like, you are lending out yourself.
Yeah.
It's not the same as like you off the clock. Yeah. In a picture.
It's a body industry. Like, it's about the body. You're kind of like, yeah, you're renting out your body for an image, which is interesting. I don't know. I'm just thinking about even when like a friend takes an image that they're taking of you, but they want to put it on their social media grid. But then you're like, no, send it to me. I want to put it up. And then it's like, they took the photo. It's on their phone, but then it's of you. So who gets to post the image? And I remember my friends and I kind of having these arguments back in like 2015, 2016 about this kind of thing. Well, who gets to post it?
Yeah, totally.
So both photos that Richard Prince had used had been images from a photo shoot where someone was like obviously hired by a publication to take the photo, likely had artistic freedom over how the shoot would look. There were definitely makeup artists and other people working on the set, maybe even like an artistic director. And like when we talk about the model as canvas, like I do know that a lot of top models have spoken about how like the creation of an editorial isn't always as black and white as like model is mannequin. A lot of the best models are often engaging in this interplay with the photographer and helping them to realize their vision. Like, it is kind of seen as an art form. So I do think it's a bit tangled when it comes to who has claim over the photo. But personally for me, I think it lies with the person who did the mechanics of taking it.
Well, I would say in these cases, it lies within the kind of institutions that own and commission the photos. Like, I don't even think the photographer owns those pictures.
Yeah, yeah,
I think
exactly.
The magazines do. Yeah. And I think that would be definitely murky territory for someone like Richard Prince to then appropriate.
Totally. And it just makes me think a lot about what it means when like the model posts that to her Instagram page. Like, Emily doesn't mention the photographers at all when she talks about the photo being used by Prince. And like, she explains that posting the photo was, quote, the only place where I could control how I present myself to the world, a shrine to my autonomy. But it's like the image had so many hands on it before it ever reached Richard Prince's gallery and before it even reached Emily's grid. And we're going to kind of get into like what happens in the process of that image going onto social media. What kind of ownership is then given up once it's in that public domain, like in that sphere? And then what happens in the process of Richard Prince taking it and putting it on a gallery wall? And I think that's a really interesting, there's so much that goes away with ownership and claims over the photo throughout those processes.
You know what this made me think of? One time I modeled for someone's a hair clip brand or a jewelry brand, and then I posted the photos to Instagram, and then Maya, when you started oil painting, you painted a picture of me from that. So you're kind of like Richard Prince.
So true. I'm
and
like
I'm
Richard
Emily
Prince.
Ratajkowski.
Except as if Richard Prince was painting images of images.
Well, I'm just saying.
Yeah, I'm exactly like I am
for Emily Ratajkowski.
Yeah.
Anyways.
I love the generosity of saying that I started oil painting. It was like a 4-month stint where I was like super depressed and I was like, what'll help this? And oil paint.
And I was impressed.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
It didn't look anything like Hannah, but whatever.
Don't.
We're moving on. So Emily and her boyfriend bought the Sports Illustrated piece for $80,000. This was a photo she had been paid $150 for up front and then a couple grand when the magazine had come out. And money is something that we'll get into later on. I do think it's a really interesting like gender dynamic at play in this essay. Like in every instance, the person taking Emily's agency away and the person doing the gazing, the active person, is a man. And I think like the boyfriend really exemplifies this. She kind of casts aspersion onto his desire to own this image of her. She describes it as like a conquest for him. And later we find out that after they broke up, he asked her to pay him $10,000 for a black and white study of herself that they had both procured. So the challenge of procurement adds like another layer to these questions of ownership, like him wanting to buy the photos. And now he owns her image. And it's like just fascinating.
I think it can speak to like a more general like gender dynamic about like men and women, but then I also think once you are also Emily Ratajkowski, and I'm sure, like, going through the world under the general knowledge that when people want things from you or they want to be around you, so much of it is tied up in the image of who you are, of the iconography of being Emily Ratajkowski, of what that symbolizes. And I think that, like, that would just be an additional level of mindfuckery.
Totally, totally. And, like, so much of Jonathan Leader's, the way that he kind of sold this disgusting book was, like, Emily Ratajkowski before she was famous. It's similar to the Marilyn Monroe thing, right? When they sold Marilyn Monroe's nudes and put them in Playboy. It's, like, a similar, like, oh, Marilyn Monroe before she was famous. Basically claiming how much proximity you had to Emily Ratajkowski. You were able to capture her and, like, put her in this, you know what I mean? Yeah. Same with the boyfriend kind of laying territory over her.
Exactly.
You know?
Like, I would just imagine that it would even be a confusing process, like, dating. Are aware of, yeah, exactly what a conquest it would be to be the man who gets to date Emily Ratajkowski.
Yeah, it's deeply objectifying. And I feel like being a sex symbol is not a cakewalk. Okay, so now we're going to look at this little devil Richard Prince. I made that sound too cute.
This little booger. This menace.
Okay, now we're going to look at this stinky guy Richard Prince, because I think his career has been super interesting. So Prince was born in the Panama Canal Zone in Panama in 1949, which was at the time a territory of the U.S. He moved to the U.S. at the age of 5 and then moved to New York as a young adult in the 70s. And his early work is defined by the use of found images from advertisements that he would then juxtapose to one another. He'd also play around with, like, grid work. Sometimes he'd take his own photos. He has this Cowboys and Girlfriends series from the 90s where, like, he'd get these women who had previously modeled for a motorcycle or, like, a biker magazine, and then he would recreate that exact image with that exact model, which is kind of fascinating. And I'll show you some of his works here. Want to describe the crux of these works, Hannah, and, like, what you think of them, just even taste-wise?
Yeah, a lot of found object. He's taking images from magazines, like, already existing ideas and concepts, recreating them in some capacity, I assume as, like, some kind of commentary on, like, the ownership of images or the process that images go through when they are displayed in certain ways, I can only assume. Mm-hmm. There's something very, like, Warhol about it, which I think I've heard that comparison between the two of them. You've also brought up that comparison between the two of them, and I think it's, like, hard to ignore that. But yeah, it's a lot of images, like you said, either recreated from magazines or just taken from magazines themselves. But yeah, I'm excited to learn more about.
Yeah, the Warhol parallels definitely there, which we will definitely be delving into. Yeah, I think the, like, general gist of the work is that it always has some element of reuse or repurposing to it, whether he's, like, yeah, taking that directly from a magazine or if he's, like, actually just recreating a photo. Prince also helped to popularize a style of photography called re-photography, which is the type of photography he's using with this, like, Instagram painting series. And it's a style of photography that's gotten him into a lot of trouble in his career many, many, many different times. But I think the most controversial instance, for very obvious reasons, is when he took a photo of an old nude photo of Brooke Shields that had been taken for Playboy Press back in 1975 when she was 10 years old. And he displayed it in a gallery in the Lower East Side, which, like, even just touching, like, getting to the surface of why that is nasty or, like, why that is just morally feels reprehensible for sure.
Yeah, well, I would say those are images that should not have existed in the first place. And to go, hey, guys, remember these images and redraw attention to them is an insane thing
in, like, to a do. Public space. In and a, like,
yeah. And for what I'm sure is, like, an insane amount of money too, like, selling those images.
Yeah, I don't know exactly what they sold for, if they sold, but
God, poor Brooke Shields, generally speaking.
Generally speaking. But she seems to be living a great life now, and I think people tend to not focus on that enough.
Yes.
But yes, very controversial, extremely. Emily describes Prince's series as a Warholian take on Instagram, which is exactly what you said, and I think kind of hits the nail on the head. He's actually outright been called the Andy Warhol of Instagram in recent years, but, like, even in his early work, around the same time that Andy Warhol was his contemporary, they were very similar. Mm-hmm. So why exactly do you think he has a Warhol kind of style to him?
Well, because I think some of Andy Warhol's most iconic imagery is repurposed images. It's like you'll take a single image, like, you know, most obvious examples, the Campbell's soup can, iconic image, and then you are basically repurposing it in different ways. You're like posting it on two different things, changing it around. But there's this idea of like reproduction. Sometimes it'll just be like, you know, a single image reproduced on a canvas over and over again. And then I think even when it comes to like portraiture, thinking about, you know, someone like Brooke Shields or Emily Ratajkowski, I mean, they are both icons in their own rights. And Andy Warhol, a lot of his portraiture like revolved around icons. And I don't even think he necessarily, like, there's the Polaroid series, but a lot of his work, it's not like he took the original photographs. He was repurposing photos of Elvis or Marilyn. I think he maybe did Jackie O. And, but like,
he
these,
did, yeah.
Yeah, these icons that weren't posing for him, but he was.
He's questioning what happens to them when they've entered like public domain, when they've, yeah. when they've become the possession of the masses, essentially, right?
And
like they belong to the masses.
Something akin to like a Campbell soup can, like yeah. something so everyday. And so, yeah, I think it's impossible to like think about the reproduction of that kind of imagery and not immediately draw a comparison to Warhol.
Yeah, that's exactly it. He was a part of this movement in the mid-20th century called pop art, mm-hmm. which, like you're saying, it's a style of art that's commenting on like artifice and commercialization. Most of you have definitely come into contact with his work at some point in your life. He's so iconic. He works with a lot of like screen printing. And like you're saying, he takes his popular iconography and he distorts it. He has the Campbell's can. He did that Marilyn Monroe photo. And what he's doing is basically abstracting them from their original context and turning them into, like I was saying, icons of mass production and consumption. And this is kind of a big thing in the latter half of the 20th century. There's a scholar named W.J.T. Mitchell who had said back in the early 90s that we were undergoing a pictorial turn in Western culture, as opposed to a linguistic turn that had happened like in the century before. And I'm going to read this quote from him that I thought was kind of interesting. He says, "The simplest way to put it is to say that in what is often characterized as an age of spectacle, surveillance, and all-pervasive image making, we still do not know exactly what pictures are, what their relation to language is, how they operate on observers and on the world, how their history is to be understood, and what is to be done with or about them." And what I'll say is that these like mid-century artists like Warhol or Jasper Johns or Cindy Sherman are commenting on this like problematization of the image, right? The image is like problematic. It's like a dilemma. And they're doing that by appropriating it and altering it, right? And it makes people uncomfortable. Like, it makes people uncomfortable seeing someone else's work taken in that way, seeing someone's face taken in that way. But that is kind of the point. I spoke to our friend Stefan, who is a photographer, because I think his art practice has a really similar kind of like ethos to this. So here's Stefan. Do you want to just like introduce yourself for our audience? Like, who are you? What do you do?
Sure. My name is Stefan Johnson. I was born and live in Vancouver, BC, in Canada, which is on the unceded ancestral territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh First Nations. Growing up, I had my hand in a lot of different art forms. Like, I grew up in a really musical family, so I was playing piano and singing, started writing music in high school. And then when I was 7, my mom signed me up for a tap and jazz class. And then from there, I actually started doing a lot of circus. My specialties were dance trapeze, which is like the bar with two ropes that come together at the top to form a triangle. So you can like spin and swing. Yeah, I did that from like 8 to 19. And I think informs my art practice as well. So I auditioned twice for the National Circus School in Montreal and then wasn't accepted. So then I was kind of like, okay, well, I'll go to art school. Yeah, ended up at Emily Carr and got my bachelor's in photography in 2020. So that was like awesome pandemic graduation. So I think, I don't know, I come into everything creative from all angles because I've sort of put my dirty little paws in all art forms, really.
You have a finger in every pie.
Exactly. And I mean, going to art school, at least my experience was that everything was very streamlined. And so for people in photography, when I started at the end of my degree doing more like sculpture, I want to say, we would go into a critique and people would just have no idea how to talk about it because they were so like photography, capital P, I don't know. I really like the fact that I have had many lives in terms of my creative processes, but it has been a challenge trying to like combine everything.
What to you makes like a good photographer?
I don't know. I think good photography really is dependent on motivation, and I think that can be said with art as well. It's like when something feels honest to me, that makes a good photograph or a good work of art. I think it's really clear when a piece of art is pandering in a way, like kind of too on the nose, if that makes sense. That being said, I will say there is a difference between like a technically good photograph and then just like a conceptually rigorous one. Yeah, I would say someone who's making work that is honest, but
That's
not
so in
necessarily truthful.
Oh, interesting. It doesn't have to be truthful.
Honest in the way that is relating to themselves and like how they approach the world, but not necessarily truthful in terms of like the world itself.
This is really interesting in dialogue with we're doing an episode on poetry and like Rupi Kaur, and I asked my friend Phoebe, who's a poet, like what she thinks makes a good poet and like what makes a good poem. And she said like emotional urgency. Which I thought, I
Right.
think is really similar kind of to your answer in terms of just like some sort of brute honesty, which I guess kind of brings me to the question of like how you approach photography and how you approach your own practice and like if you could even describe your work for people and
I don't know. I struggle to describe my practice at this point only because I'm not really practicing that much in terms of like I'm pretty inconsistent with making work. As I said, I graduated in 2020. So that really like kind of knocked the wind out of me. And so I've been trying the past few years to get back into making work. In high school, I got into photography because I was really shy and it was a way for me to connect with people that I thought were cool. I'd be like, Facebook Messenger. So photography for me was a way for me to make friends and a way for me to express myself that felt fun because it was collaborative. So yeah, I would say the base of my photography practice is portraiture because that's where it all started. And then in school, I started doing more like I said, more sculptural. And so like combining photography, trying to sort of take it off the wall because we would go into these critiques and it would just be like a photograph pinned up on a wall and we'd talk about what was in the photograph. But I just ended up getting a little bit bored with that. And so I was like, how can I make a photograph that is not just a picture? And so I would say that my practice has two streams, one being portraiture and like also fashion, portraiture and fashion. And then the other stream is like more sculptural, maybe a little bit of collage thrown in.
Is there kind of like something that changes about the photography once it's taken off the wall? Like, does that kind of like change the work of art for you in any way?
It definitely makes it appear more as an object. And that was something that I was exploring as well, is like photography as object versus just an image. And so when you take a photograph off the wall, you're kind of forced to contend with the space around it and its relationship to that space, which is something that sculpture does a lot. When you take a photograph off the wall, you are giving it a body in a sense that is beyond just like what is it in the photograph?
So this is something Richard Prince was doing as well. And given the time around when he started, you could definitely say he like belonged to this movement or was at least like a child of it. He came
He was a bit younger.
a bit younger, yeah, it came a bit later. How do you think re-photography plays into this idea of like the pictorial turn and that like the image is a problem?
I guess it's like because if you recreate an image that already exists or repurpose it, and then put your own name on it. It doesn't question like the meaning behind images. And, I think we think about things being taken from somebody's perspective and point of view. And we think about like the hand of the artist in these situations. But like once something has been taken and then by a new person not thinking from that point of view, like the image loses its meaning or the meaning changes
Yeah.
and it kind of draws into question like the whole idea of imagery as like symbolism and like what it comes to represent.
That's exactly it. a theme comes up a lot in like Emily Ratajkowski's article, even with the original intent of an image. Like, oh, that image was meant to be taken for this publication. Like, even with the Jonathan Leader thing, right? If he had taken those images for a publication, that's what she thinks he's doing with them. And then him taking different images from that shoot, but like, you know, images from that same shoot for a publication, putting them in a book, the intent behind it changes. The intent becomes insidious.
And also, like, the money.
And the money changes.
We can't ignore money in this situation, especially with commercial works.
Well, totally. And we will definitely get into that. Re-photography is exactly how it sounds. It's taking a photograph of an already existing photograph. I read this really great interview with Prince where the interviewer describes his work as the most compelling evidence of a genuinely postmodern phase of visual art. Because postmodernism is all about spectacle and like the superficiality of things. It's exactly what Warhol and these artists were doing. Richard Prince is basically taking a photograph of a photograph and then he's removing it from its context and putting it up for exhibition in a totally other context. Re-photography isn't so much about the actual work. It's about like how and where the work exists.
It's distribution.
Yeah, it's distribution and the process by which it came into existence, which is something that's so interesting that this episode is going to focus on when it comes to social media. Prince said that he got into re-photography because he wasn't into the concept of doing impressions. And he thinks re-photography is all about like over-determination. Like he's playing with this idea of truth. He's saying that he's recreating the truth. A point of like discord with photography is this idea that, like, the camera is this objective object and that anything it captures is the truth. This was like a huge aspect of like my grad thesis because I specialized in visual culture. This is a big justification for the prevalence of like photojournalism, for example, which is what my thesis was about. But a lot of people have argued that the camera isn't objective. So I spoke to Stefan about this. Like, I know this is a whole debate within the world of photography about like the camera being this like objective tool and like it's telling a truth about the world, or like the truth about the world. And then there's been a lot of pushback to that and people being like, it doesn't. So I just wanted to know, yeah, what your take is on that idea.
I mean, aside from the first maybe 20, 30 years of the history of photography, I don't know that the photograph has ever been totally truthful or objective. And even in, from a technical standpoint, photo negatives have been doctored forever. Or in the printing process, there's an adjustment of light levels or contrast or whatever. Like, no photograph is ever going to be totally truthful. And the camera is definitely not objective because no human being is. Ultimately, there's someone pressing the shutter button. They're choosing how to frame the photograph. Everything is a choice, and so it can't be objective.
The camera can never tell like an absolute truth because there's always a person behind the camera, right?
And of course.
So, yeah, and that's kind of what Stefan is talking about. And Prince talks about this. He describes the camera as like a pair of electronic scissors and using it to see how closely he could capture the original image and how much people would believe his photo too. His interviewer says, our thinking changed from believing the camera told the truth to an understanding that the camera believes what it's told. So by taking a photo of another photo, he's kind of like transforming that original photo from a photograph to an object, like Stefan kind of does with his work.
Right.
Which makes you question like all the mechanics that went behind the creation of the original photo. So could you imagine why Instagram would be the perfect subject of a re-photography series? Like, what do you think it is about Instagram that he's commenting on, or why he was so happy to kind of get his grubby little hands in there?
Well, because it's a place that exists solely for displaying images, and photos are taken for Instagram, or like when they're posted to Instagram, they take on new meaning. Previously, we had photographs, like, I guess you shared them to Facebook, but like in a pre-social media age, like your photographs were for you. They were for like the home, or they were to be displayed explicitly. Mm-hmm. Whereas here, there's kind of like this middle ground where things are being taken to be displayed, but it's not in like the way that something editorial or like documentary or like, you know, artistic are meant to be displayed. Like, they're personal objects, but they're meant to be consumed by more people than the immediately like concerned people.
Well, even thinking about the evolution from Facebook to Instagram and like the words that they use, like Facebook has photo albums, you know, that's meant to be stored for you. We would take like 700,000 DSLR photos.
Oh yeah, you'd post even the duds.
Like, yeah, even the duds. It's just for your memory. Facebook's so focused on the idea of memories. That's its entire purpose these days, for our generation at least, is like, oh, this memory from 15 years ago.
And, you like, know. In a pre-carousel post, Instagram especially, like, you are picking the singular image to encapture something.
It's called a grid also, which is different than a photo album. And then now we have, like, an archive function, because before you would just have to delete a photo if you didn't want it on your grid. Yeah. Now it's like you can archive it, so there is the memory element, but then that's separate from the display element.
And it just, like, it inspires a level of curation that the average person previously was never putting into photography. Like, we weren't curating the pictures that we put in our family photo albums, per se.
What do you mean? I wanted all of my family photos to be soft beige and pink. Like, obviously.
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 Instagram has changed what images are. I think that they've taken, like, the average photograph and, like, packed them with so much more meaning than ever before.
Totally. And do you think it's changed the idea of public access, or, like, who opens the photo once it gets there?
Oh, sure. I mean, God, I should really read terms and conditions on social media apps, because I'm sure that Mark Zuckerberg owns all of my pictures.
People should be reading the terms and conditions and what they're giving up once the photo goes online.
But then I also think perhaps just in today's age, we've all kind of let go of this idea of ownership anyways. You know, you can find anything on Google Images, you can screenshot anything, you can...
Well, which is why Richard Prince coming into this is so interesting, because we think we've given this up, but then when Richard Prince comes in and takes it and puts it on a wall, we're like, oh, that's my image, right? And so it's interesting.
Yeah.
So he said that Instagram feels like it was created for someone like him. And he's described it as a gallery in your pocket, and that it reminded him of a free concert, which he's such a little, like, ghoul. I don't know. It's so funny to me. Just his, he's, like, so unabashedly ghoulish.
He's the seagulls in Finding Nemo. He's like, mine.
He's like, yeah. And I think he's right that it's perfectly suited for the kind of work he does. There's a couple things that he's saying with this Instagram series. First off, I think he's kind of blurring the boundaries between the digital image and the hard copy photograph, right? Like, by taking the digital image out of this, like, ephemeral world that it exists in and then putting it within the four walls of a gallery, he's recontextualizing this, like, Instagram image that's seen more as a form of content when it exists on social media, and then turning it into high art, right? And showing us how quick that process really is, like, especially if you have name recognition. Like, he's kind of giving you the finger and being like, look what I can do.
Well, you know. Also, like, nothing kind of displays the silliness of the art world more than this. More exactly. than the idea of someone spending the money.
And I think he knows that. Like, I think it's very wink-wink.
Right, of course.
Which is interesting. The other thing is that much of the way Prince has evaded a lot of legal issues, although he's definitely, like, had his fair share of them, is that he's transforming the work just enough to be considered fair use. So I run into fair use issues all the time on YouTube. My video essays are essentially fair use of the material that I'm using, which is often, like, movie clips, because I'm transforming it, right? I'm making it into commentary. It's often couched between narration, or there's narration over top of the image, like, all this stuff. He's kind of doing the same thing, but, like, the bare minimum of it. How do you think he transforms the work?
I don't know. Does he, like, slightly, like, change the exposure or something? Or is it just putting them on canvas that is transformation?
I think the exposure would be, like, the barest of minimums. He does a bit more than that. He does it by leaving a comment under that image and then leaving that comment on the canvas to kind of frame the way that we view that image.
Okay.
The thing is that a lot of his comments, especially under images of scantily clad women, are really sleazy.
Oh, really? Like, what?
So, like, one under one of Emily's, he was like, "Were you built in a science lab by teenage boys?" And even if it's, like, innocuous, just the fact that he's an older man commenting on these images of young girls is creepy. Another one was not actually his comment, but some comment in, like, another language. And it was a guy telling her that her tits look saggy, which she had to, like, translate online.
And is this any of this done with even the slightest bit of irony, or what?
It's hard to say. And I think it's ironic, but, like, it's not immediately apparent, right? And someone just going into a gallery is going to be like, who's this fucking sleazebag, right?
I also think, you know, when the thesis of your work is all about, like, the appropriation of images and, like, the distribution of it, adding this element lends the kind of, like, false idea that it's commenting somehow on women and how they're displayed in media or social media. But I really doubt how... Well, I don't think actually. But I don't...
Could you argue that this is kind of by design? He says in that interview that I read that he's always trying to figure out what his relationship to this image is, to this original image. And I kind of think that's what he's doing here. Like, who is Prince? This old guy on social media. Who is he in relation to an image of some young woman he doesn't know, right? This writer, Julia Turbiglio, has this quote where she says that in the process of exhibiting these photos, the invisible public of Instagram users, whose vastness and sketchiness the girls could probably never fully considered, is transformed in the more tangible presence of the contemporary arts audience. And like, yeah, Emily talks about seeing these dudes like walk around the gallery and looking at these pictures of her from Jonathan Leder's exhibition, because he had also exhibited the photos he took of her. And I think with Prince leaving that comment, like, he's showing us this invisible audience, which is himself, and he's kind of drawing attention to it by putting it on the canvas. And also he's creating a physical audience to that photo. Like, it's both him showing the audience, like showing out of the masses of comments under Emily Ratajkowski's photo, he's bringing to light just one example of like the many sleazy comments that are under there. Listen, I'm not saying I like it morally.
Like,
he's making the invisible masses real.
Yeah, I get it.
Like, you might not like it, and I don't like it morally either, but that is kind of the point. Like, that's what he's doing, right?
Yeah, no, I don't even, like, dislike it from, like, a place of feminism so much as I'm like, okay, cool. Like, we know that men will post sleazy comments under Emily Ratajkowski's photos.
Well, it's just, like, maybe a taste thing. You just don't like the work.
Yeah, perhaps.
But, like, I do think it is saying something by doing that. Like, I think being able to see men walking around a gallery and looking at these photos that millions more of them are just looking at in private on their phones and, like, commenting, millions of them are commenting sleazy things, but bringing to light just one of those sleazy comments, like, that is kind of saying something. You're materializing an invisible audience. You're saying something about an ephemeral audience on social media, right? By making it physical. Neither of us likes the art, but yeah, that's what the art is saying about social media. Do you think Emily Ratajkowski is, like, kind of misunderstanding re-photography, or do you think she's bringing up a critical angle with which to view photography on Instagram?
I think, again, the tricky part with Emily Ratajkowski here is that the images being taken are images that already weren't hers to begin with. And I think when she posts images taken of her for a publication owned by that publication on her own grid, like, she is in a sense doing what Richard Prince is doing on a different scale, which is, like, taking them as her own. And, you know, the meaning behind those specific images is no longer, like, whatever, selling the product or selling the magazine. When it's posted on her grid, the meaning is selling herself in some way, right? Like, the image has already gone through, like, a level of transformation. I do think it's different from, like, if I were to post just a photo of myself and have that be taken, I would feel perhaps a level more of, like, ownership. I think that perhaps the Richard Prince stuff just kind of lends into a general valid conundrum she finds herself in as a model and as someone who's had the very specific experiences that she's had.
But outside of, like, Emily Ratajkowski, like, why do you think his use of Instagram images has been particularly problematic for people? Like, the specific use of Instagram images, because this has gotten so much media attention in the way that, like, he's been doing this kind of stuff for years, but just once he started taking stuff from Instagram is when it really took off and, like, became super controversial.
Well, because I think, especially at the time that this was happening, like, we've been working out what process our images and our thoughts and everything go through once they've been posted online, and, like, whether or not we still own them, whether or not they're up for public consumption. I think going back to the idea of, like, intention, if you post an image on Instagram, you're not posting it with the intention of it then being, like, appropriated in this further way or, like, redistributed. And I think it just perhaps was a reminder to people that, like, social media changes things and that an image posted to social media is different from, like, an image put up on your wall at home. Mm-hmm. And I think it's kind of scary to think about how we share these pieces of ourselves online and then by virtue of that, like, lose those things because they become public domain in some capacity.
Even just going back to the idea of, like, the Sports Illustrated image and, like, what type of image that becomes once it goes online, once it's, like, shared on Emily Ratajkowski's grid, once it's, like, reframed in that way versus, like, as it would have appeared originally in the publication, like, it's losing that original intention by going on to Emily Ratajkowski's grid. And like she's saying, the new intention of her posting it on her grid is like, oh, this idea of like reclaiming ownership over the photo, reclaiming agency, that changes it. But then once it's on social media, yeah, like there is no agency over the photo at all. It's like it exists on social media. Anyone can just screen grab it, which is what you're saying. I think Instagram just throws the concept of photography into question by like turning a photograph into content that can then be repurposed over and over and over again. Like there's this really cool concept that was originated by this researcher named Sabine Niederer at the Amsterdam University of Applied Sciences called the networked image. I learned about it a few years ago, but I think about it all the time, especially with our podcast and like the fact that it's about the internet. But basically it like raises the point that once an image reaches the internet, it becomes networked in the sense that it's often like hyperlinked. You can comment on it and like reframe it with comments like he's kind of doing with his comment. Like the photo may not have been sleazy to begin with, but now there's an element of sleaze to it. It can be reframed by like the number of likes it has. Like if it has millions of likes, we think differently of it. It can be shared across platforms and it takes on new meaning with every platform it goes on. It's like a video from TikTok going onto Twitter, like becoming something else.
Well, yeah, it's like an interactive thing. It's no longer like a one-dimensional thing.
Yeah, like the participatory idea. And like just even thinking about memes and the way that they spread across the internet, like the whole point of them is to be like reappropriated in a number of different contexts, which is what makes them so funny. You're just taking one image and then you're putting new text on it to change what that image means. And then you're sharing it across the internet. So like that's a networked image in like its truest sense. Stefan touched on this a bit. But yeah, do you think for you, is there any like real difference just in the definitions of like an image versus a photograph?
Yes. An image is different than a photograph because an image is the content of the photograph. And then the photograph is the thing that's housing the image. So yeah, the photograph is the physical thing, whereas the image is what's in the photograph.
Would you say that like something you see on your social media feed, would you consider that a photograph, or like would it have to undergo some other process in order to become a photograph?
By the logic that I just used, no. The images we see on social media are not photographs, because to me, a photograph is the physical object. But I mean, I'm sure people would disagree with me, and that is totally awesome.
I don't think we've really come to a conclusion about what a photograph really is. And I think social media has kind of like thrown that into question even more.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, it's like the question, what is art? You can never answer that because it's so subjective, I guess. For me, it's a little bit less subjective in terms of like the difference between a photograph and an image, but definitely like what is a photograph is an impossible question.
This is kind of something Emrata is getting at in her essay. Like she talks about how all these men are like debating the use of her image in the print series, and then remembers in that instance how her ex, who was also part of this debate, has a number of naked images of her on his phone, and how she was also a part of that Celebgate scandal where like a bunch of her nudes were leaked that we talked about in Is Anyone Up? And basically she's questioning like how quickly ownership over your own image gets away from you the second it lands, not even on the internet, sometimes just on your iCloud, which was the case with Is Anyone Up?
And also, I mean, this is a bit of a leap, but there's these new search engines that they're developing where basically you can, if you have a picture of somebody, you can find any image of them on the internet. Like, and it's apparently scary good, and it's terrifying. And the idea of images are no longer even just confined to specific spaces, right? People would be like, Instagram is for my friends and Facebook is for my family. And you would think that you could have these separate lives. But like, ultimately, the internet is just a big melting pot.
Totally. And like, if you Google name search, you know, like if you go to Google Images, a bunch of your images from all these different platforms are then going to be amalgamated under one search engine, which is so scary. I remember back in like 2013 or maybe 14, I think I was in university, but my mom was bored and she searched my name on Google, and the first image that came up was me chugging a 40.
What? Why? Where? Instagram?
In a swimsuit.
Girl, Instagram?
No, on Google Images. I think it had been taken from, I can't remember where it had existed before that. I don't know if it was Instagram. I don't know where it came from. I think Instagram's actually pretty good at keeping the images off Google search engines, but yeah, which is kind of crazy.
I mean, that doesn't even shock me. Like, I did not give a shit in high school about what I posted to Facebook. Didn't care what family I had on there. Like, I posted pictures of people partying all throughout high school. So like, I kind of accept crazy. I kind of accepted maybe I was too young and stupid to make that decision, but that like I can't do the thing where you're like I have to have a really clean social media presence for future jobs.
Ain't no such thing.
Yeah, because it's thing. You know, yeah.
Okay. If I'm being like as fair as I possibly can be, because like I am in a place in my life where I'm trying to look at art from the absolute most bird's eye view possible, I do see like the artistic justification behind re-photography and other appropriation art. But in addition to like the sleaziness of Richard Prince's distinct style
brand,
the other biggest issue with it for me is that the original artists and subjects, which we were getting at earlier, often made pennies off the work compared to what these appropriation artists are making. This was a big topic of discussion last year when this photographer named Lynn Goldsmith sued Andy Warhol's estate for licensing an image he had made out of a photograph that she had taken of Prince, the singer. It's unfortunate that there are now two Princes in this episode. She had taken it of Prince, the singer, decades prior. I think we're just so accustomed to Warhol's work now that we don't often question like the originators of these iconic images. Like, you don't really think about who took that image of Marilyn Monroe, right? Which was, I think, a publicity still.
Well, yeah, and also, I mean, with Warhol, you know that basically all of those, like, big famous pop art pictures, like, there are so many hands touching that. Like, he is not doing that himself.
Oh, totally.
Like, so, yeah, well, yeah. You kind of just come to accept that Warhol, it almost feels like a brand more than an artist, I think, in that stage of his career. Obviously, like, he did other things. He was an illustrator. He had other bodies of work, but yeah.
Oh, God, we could probably make an entire episode about, oh, my God, just finding out that artists, when they reach a certain level, like, they don't make their own work. Other people do. They just design the work. It was fucking mind-blowing, and I think there could be a lot to be said there about that.
But with him, I think it was the whole point.
That's the whole point. Goldsmith made about $400 off a licensing fee when Warhol's images was initially used in the magazine back in the 80s, but she wasn't seeing any money of its like reuse here for the issue that was being released today. Our friend Fox also experienced having his image re-photographed by Richard Prince.
Which is crazy.
So crazy. Fox was kind of an icon of like early 2010s Tumblr because he had known the now renowned photographer Petra Collins, who would take these like really beautiful photos of Fox and his friends when they were in high school, which were featured in Rookie Mag and then would go like mega viral online. And Fox left a statement with me explaining what had happened with Richard Prince. He says, "In 2014, at the age of 18, I found myself unwittingly involved in Richard Prince's gallery show. He took screenshots of various people's Instagram posts, enlarged them, and displayed them without any consent. One of those screenshots happened to be from my then-girlfriend's Instagram post, featuring a picture of me shirtless on a bed with her lying on my back. When I was made aware of it, I was just confused. Why us? Why that picture? At first, I was a bit flattered, but then it struck me as odd. He didn't ask anyone if he could use those images. Then again, I don't think Andy Warhol asked Coca-Cola for permission. Having said that, it's not the same at all. Warhol used images and logos from massive celebrities and corporations. Prince used an Instagram post from a couple of 18-year-olds from Toronto. I understand art being used to shock or start conversation, but I thought the show was just lame and lazy. Just felt like an old man discovered the internet and was like, look what I could do. So true. I actually don't hate his work, but I hated this. It felt like a lame attempt at staying relevant. I also thought it was gross to be profiting from a bunch of people's images who are complete strangers to him. When I heard what my image sold for, I was not happy. A life-changing amount. So yeah, fuck Richard Prince."
I mean, if I had that specific experience, that would probably be my feeling as well.
Yeah, and Fox, when I was speaking to him, was like so fair about it, which was interesting, but like, yeah, he's 18, and in the photo, he's shirtless, which is also just so, like, it's such a vulnerable image. And then Prince had commented, back to the sleazy comment, under the photo, he had commented, "What you's covering there?" Or, like, "What are you covering there?" Which, like, could be in relation to, like, the laptop in front of Fox's, like, chest, which is just fucking nasty.
I learned about Richard Prince because I remember there being an article about this specific incident in the Toronto Star, and that was sort of my awareness of it. And I do think, like, my over the course of this episode, like, some of my views have like changed about him.
Wow.
well, just in talking about it theoretically as art, but then I also think just
there's a human element to it.
There's a human element. There's, again, the distinction between what is something taken on an iPhone, you know, in the intimacy of someone's bedroom. Of course, you're putting it online for consumption, but again, with the very different intentions, and like there's no money being passed around. They weren't paid for that photograph originally.
Yeah.
Versus, you know, again, somebody doing a photo shoot for a magazine and that being appropriated.
Yeah.
I also think it says different things, right? Totally. There is so much to be said about model, muse, photographer, all those roles when you then put it in the context of re-photography versus this is so much a smaller scale. It's like two people taken, like a photograph of them taken outside of like any kind of commercial intention.
It's so different.
No
yeah,
one from was the hired for anything.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's exactly what Fox is saying in that statement. The courts ended up ruling in Goldsmith's favor, and I have a lot of mixed feelings about that ruling myself. Like, it did set kind of a potentially dangerous precedent for, like, artistic freedom, and I think a lot of people in the art community were concerned about what that would mean for them. But I do think it's important that original artists, or even, like, the subjects of the photos, at least make some sort of commission off the use of their work, at least when it's sold for hundreds of thousands of dollars. Like, Fox saw nothing from that Richard Prince photo, which I can't remember the exact number. I don't think he can remember the exact number, but he had speculated that it had gone for like thousands and thousands of dollars.
Well, I'd imagine, yeah.
And same with Emrata. Like, she had to spend $80,000 on it, which I think was like most. She said that it cost, it was a huge dent in her like savings, essentially. The rat brain part of me does kind of wonder whether you have to almost like, in a villain way, almost like commend them for being smart enough to like manipulate the market like that, just in terms of the way that he's able to sell that image. But again, it doesn't justify the people that aren't making the money off of it.
Of course. I mean, again, I think that there's a lot of industries that when you actually look at like what is being sold for lots of money, like a lot of it is fucking stupid. And a lot of it, I do think that people are kind of, I just think that, like, sometimes the art world has a lot of mass hysteria where people will, like, trick themselves into believing in the value of certain things and whatever. Like, it's fascinating. It's also, like, that's rich people problems for the most part. But I just think it's interesting and perhaps captures our attention when normal people who are not part of that world, who have not signed up to be a part of that world, are then inserted into it, like Fox.
Yeah, like, the credence I'll give to Richard Prince is that, you know, unlike, the, you know, you're seeing these like rich people buy stuff for like thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars that's like basically just a canvas with like gangster Bugs Bunny on it, and they're spending so much money on it. And I guarantee you the artist who made gangster bad big I guarantee you the artist who made gangster Bugs Bunny is not like they're probably quite serious about their art, whereas like Richard Prince definitely knows what he's doing and definitely knows that he's like manipulating the market like this.
Sure.
But yeah, again, what the difference with him is that there's a real human cost to what he's doing.
Like, I can respect trolling for trolling's sake.
Yeah, he's a troll.
But like, I would also be pissed if someone made that much money off of my image when licensed.
What was the tweet? There was a tweet that was like, RIP Andy Warhol, your lazy ass would have loved AI.
true. Like, and that's the other thing, though, is that I do think as much as there is something troubling about limiting artistic freedom and like the ability to appropriate works, I do wonder like if it helps protect people from having their works reused in AI, used in training AI.
I don't know if that ruling does include AI, but like maybe it'll get the ball rolling.
Because I think that this is going to be an ongoing battle. And I'm thinking also in terms of music and in terms of sampling and in terms of like fair use in that sense. Like, how do we protect people's intellectual property while also allowing for appropriation of pre-existing works? Because so much of art is built on that, especially like art today.
Yeah, so, I think like maybe the fear is smaller artists who are maybe doing commissioned work are going to have to pay like the fee for them to even use an image will like put them out, basically. It's just like murky territory, but a good conversation to be had. So I just want to end off with a chat about like what exactly photography is and where it's at as an art form. Because again, I keep prancing around telling everyone photography's dead. Do I believe it? No, but like
poetry's
I like
dead.
Saying it.
Photography's dead.
Yeah, those are my two things I like to say. Because with all this talk about Instagram and ownership and like networked images, it just makes you think about whether Instagram's kind of like disrupted the boundaries of photography in an irreparable way. Like, do you think it's easier to be proficient in photography than, say, an art form like poetry because it's like this mechanized art form? Like, the beginning of photography is just this tool that's constantly being optimized to make it easier and easier for more people to use, right?
Yes and no. I mean, I can take a picture on my iPhone and it will basically do the work of adjusting, you know, how much light it takes in and all of that stuff like for me. But when I actually like take out my camera, and I guess I could put it on an automatic setting, but usually that doesn't actually look that good. Like if I want to actually like take a good photo on my camera, like I have to know those skills. Mm-hmm. And like I do think, obviously, I'm sure it's not the hardest thing to learn. I think that like Instagram has allowed us to perhaps all be proficient at a certain type of photography, but I think perhaps a widespread proficiency in that photography has like made it harder and like more rare to be a competent like real photographer, in that you're like contributing something to an art form that perhaps is more limited in the bounds that you can go to within it.
Yeah, I think maybe that's what the boundary is, that it's disrupted, is that like it's less and less easy to be a good
or original.
Capital P photographer, original photographer, which is kind of why I like to say photography's dead, because I'm like, social media has kind of made photographers of us all. Like, we are, in essence, all photographers. So it's disrupted the boundaries of the photographer, capital P, and like what that means. Obviously, there are still photographers and they do exhibitions and they like make money off their work. They're making art, but it's hard to know now these days. Like, yeah, who is good and who isn't. My favorite essay of all time is by Walter Benjamin. I talk about it all the fucking time. I've probably talked about it on this podcast. But it's called The Work of Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction, and it's about how art has slowly lost its aura. The aura is this quality that like a painting or a sculpture, let's say, has as it exists in time and space. And this is because new technology has made it easier and easier to reproduce art. So where like the real Mona Lisa has this aura around it that people are traveling to go see, they're going, they're taking photos, it's like a pilgrimage. A photo of the Mona Lisa on Google Images does not have that aura. And there's like a bajillion Mona Lisas on Google Images. And Benjamin says that technology is slowly reducing the need for human beings in the creation of certain artworks, which is why, again, like the rote skills of a photographer are so different. Stefan, talk to me a bit about like the history of the technical skills of a photographer. Just based on your general knowledge of photography, could you explain some of like kind of like just like the kind of like a bit of a brief like summary of the history of photography in the past few decades? Like, are there any differences between, you know, the way someone would take a photograph in like the 1970s as opposed to now, let's say?
Yeah, I think photography has changed a lot in the last few decades because of the way that it has become more accessible. Like if we're thinking way, way back, you know, 1800s, early 1900s, photographers were not really artists. They were more like chemists because everything was done using chemistry. The normal person wouldn't have access to a darkroom or a like humongous camera to do wet plate photography or whatever. So they'd go to these studios to get their pictures taken. And so as the cameras got smaller and the technology progressed in a way that made it more accessible, I think there's a reframing around the importance of photography. And especially now that everyone has a cell phone with an incredible camera on it, the way that people view photographers or photography as an art form is like different. I don't want to say downgraded or like it's become less important or anything like that, because I don't believe that. If anything, photography has become more important. It's just that the way that photography is being thought of is different.
I just think the iPhone has made it so that anyone can point this object at anything and take a photo of it. And then because it's like digitized, they can immediately upload it to Instagram. And like Richard Prince is saying, it's like their little pocket gallery. And boom, they are in essence a photographer, which has made me question like what a good photography is.
I think this is sort of the case with a lot of visual art, is that, I mean, a lot of people can paint as good as like the freaking masters, right?
The freaking masters.
But I just mean like any guy could paint something as good in quality as like
me, for example.
Yeah, your painting of me is comparable to the Mona Lisa.
Well, yeah.
But I think lots of people can do a thing, but I do think that that's where like the role of the artist and the intention of the artist and the statement of the artist does matter. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Like, yes, we don't need human beings to create images, but people aren't making an object for the sake of making an object most of the time. Like, if they're making a sculpture, they're trying to express something with that. And, like, that's where the artist is important. Yes, we have their vision, but it's also, like, their intention. It's the, like, little choices that they make. Mm-hmm. And that's why you can sell a painting that, like, when people are like, oh, a toddler could have painted that. My cat could have painted that. It's like, yeah, but what would your cat have been saying when it painted that, right?
An insane sentence. Yes. And this is something I talked to Stefan about. This is something Stefan also kind of reiterated. In what ways do you think, like, for you, social media has impacted photography as an art form? Like, how has it changed it? Are there, like, pros? Are there cons to it?
I mean, I got into photography because of social media, because of Tumblr and, like, the images I was seeing on there. And then also there was, like, a really big community of teenagers who were kind of running Instagram in, like, 2011, 2012, who would do, like, the 365-day challenge, where it was, like, you'd make some sort of surreal photograph every day for a whole year. And so I remember, you know, being 13, 14, seeing these people on Instagram who were similar to my age, if not my age, making these really incredible artworks where they had, like, butterfly wings and stuff, or, like, floating in the sky with balloons. And I was like, I want to do that. So I think for me, social media really impacted me because I would not have, I mean, maybe I would have ended up doing photography ultimately, but the reason I started photography was because I was inspired by what I was seeing on social media. So that for me is a good thing. Now, I will say in the last, you know, 5 years, when did Instagram start doing the Instagram shop feature?
Oh, like 2 years ago, 1 year ago? Really, pretty recently.
I don't know, just the way that everything has become so commercialized, and, like, when you don't scroll on your following tab on Instagram and you're just on your, like, home tab or whatever, it's like every third post is an ad for something. And so I think the way that social media has impacted photography now is, like, and this sort of goes back to what I was saying about the way that photography has shifted within culture. I think, yes, of course, photography has been used as a tool for marketing for forever, but it's like that sort of aspect of it has been increased exponentially because of the way that social media is so much about selling something now. And so that to me is a negative, because as much as an artist, you need to live and, like, make money off of your creative output, it feels like the idea of being a starving artist is just not sustainable. And, like, with social media and the way that it has become so about selling yourself, essentially, I think that has negatively impacted photography, because now it's like photography is just marketing.
Yeah, I think that's, like, a similar thing that's happening in the film industry too. Like, a lot of people I know who are directors are feeling like the only way that they can make money is working in commercials. And, like, I think similar to different photographers I know, like, brands oriented content is, like, the only way to actually make money off of what you do. I guess that goes for, like, every art form, but yeah, I think it would be so exponential with photography because Instagram is, like, it's like a visual medium. Do you think, like, the camera kind of being in everyone's hands, like, everyone kind of, you know, having a phone, for example, like, do you think that that makes us all photographers? Like if some, would you say that someone picking up their iPhone and, like, taking photos and putting it on Instagram and it gets a bunch of likes, like, would that qualify them as a photographer? Like, what do you think does qualify someone as a photographer?
As much as I'm all for access and the democratization of art, and also, like, I don't like when art feels alienating. And so I think what makes a photographer is some sort of understanding of their relationship to the world around them, because you need to have some sort of conceptual framework that you're working with if you are going to call yourself a photographer. And that doesn't have to be, like, super intense or whatever. It doesn't have to be, like, you've read all these essays. Every artwork is about one specific line from this one essay from whenever. It's not what it has to be about. But just as long as you, like, are being honest with yourself and how you relate to the world around you and like your position in the world, and you're making photographs, then sure, you can call yourself a photographer. That being said, I do love shot on iPhone. That is
wonderful. We love shot on iPhone. Sean Baker. Yeah. I'm getting the sense, yeah, you're kind of getting at like this idea of like intentionality and like almost like someone who has like kind of like an inherent like observational motive, which now that when I think about like all of the photographers I love, that is like a quality that they have. Do you want to list out some photographers that you really like? And then maybe just if you want to promote any of your work or like anything at all, your socials, like whatever you want to do, you can end off with that. Tell people where to find you.
I'm going to probably butcher her last name, but her name is Natasha Catedralis. She's making work that is combining photography and sculpture and making a photograph an object, which is like exactly what I love about photography, is when people kind of push the boundaries of what is a photograph. And then another artist that I am really inspired by is Marisa Holmes. I think she's based in New York now, but she's from Vancouver, I believe. She makes like some digital collage and then like is also really invested in the framing, like how the photograph is framed after, like that sort of aspect of presentation, which I think gets sort of thrown to the wayside a lot. Yeah, those are two artists that I'm really inspired by.
I'll link for them both in the description. So, like, questions of ethics in photography aren't new at all. Like, a couple years ago, I went to see this exhibit of Mary Ellen Mark's Ward 81, which is the series from 1979 that captures, like, a group of women living in a high-security psych ward in Oregon. And the images sent jolts through my body. Like, it is such a harrowing series. None of them are explicit. Like, there's nothing like that, but it's just the way she kind of like snatches the souls of these women, or like captures their souls in their eyes, is so painful and beautiful. And when I saw it, I was like, that is art. And I had just been in this student exhibit like right before that, which of course they're students, it's like a complete, like, how are you supposed to compare? But like, there were so many images that felt so overly academic and to me just didn't feel like photography, in the sense that it was like, oh, a digital photograph of like a paperclip on a desk, and then it would have an artist statement that was like three paragraphs long, and it's like, okay, so I understand you had intention behind it, but like, I have to get a feeling from this. I don't think all art, I actually kind of do think all art needs to make you feel something, whether that be good or bad or numb, I don't know, but like, I was a bit like, what is that? Mm-hmm. But then it's like, the Ward 81 series has also come under so much scrutiny for profiting off of images of these women, some of whom died soon after, none of whom could consent to, you know, taking part in the series and being like immortalized in that way. Like, that's how these women are going to be remembered throughout history, who these women who had lives and personalities, yeah. And, you know, and of course it goes into their personalities and there's so much information about who these women are, but it's still like they can't fully consent to that. And so it also raises similar questions about agency that like Emily Ratajkowski does in her essay. So it is a problem that's kind of plagued photography for forever.
For sure. Well, I think there's a difference though between like maybe perhaps exploitation of people who are still at least somewhat willing participants in the photography versus, I guess, they're just like different feel. Like what Richard Prince is doing is just ostensibly like a completely different thing.
Totally. But I just think even like we think of Richard Prince as the most extreme example, but even in examples of photography that we're like, wow, that is capital A art. Mm. It's still plaguing that. Like that is still a question, sure. Right? Like that's still a problematic thing. Like I just think photography, you're capturing a human subject, right? And I think any photograph that captures a human subject is going to have this kind of terrible push and pull between who has agency in that process.
Well, for sure. I think, I mean, it's similar to like documentary, which is just when you set out to capture real life and do it like honestly and all of that, you know, real life is messy. Real life involves real human beings, and I think there's just always going to be room for like controversy and for the potential of like taking advantage of people.
Well, with a documentary, like I think the reason they're so similar is because you're taking these real human beings, but then you're making choices like as the director, as a photographer, to narrativize those human beings and to immortalize them. So it's always going to be this like ethical minefield.
In my limited experience in creating like nonfiction work, you realize like you're playing God. Like you can manipulate things so easily to tell the narrative you want to tell.
Oh, totally.
And like photography is a bit different because you have limited things to work with. It's like an image. Mm-hmm. But like even thinking about in photography class in high school, I remember our teacher showing us like Diane Arbus photos. And we were supposed to try and like guess what was going on in the image, like that famous image of the little boy holding the plastic grenade. And we were trying to like guess the context and like what was going on. And really, he was like a little boy in the park and she'd like handed that to him.
Well, it's like that famous image of, oh my God, who took it? It's an iconic image from the Great Depression of a woman and her two children who were like impoverished. But it turns out that actually the photo had been stylized to look like, of course, the woman had been poor, but it was like, I think they left out certain kids. Like, there were other kids she had. Like, I don't know, just the way that they had framed it. And, like, I think they put dirt on her face. Like, and it's a famous image and it's a perfect image. It was a beautiful way to encapsulate the Great Depression. So, can we hate it? No. Like, it did its job.
And I think there's just so much more room to guess the stories leading up to that moment.
Oh, yeah.
And we have so much less to work with that, like, our mind fills in the blanks.
Well, think about that woman who was on the cover of National Geographic. Like, it's just an image of a woman with beautiful eyes, but it's like, what was her life like before this? Then they did the image years later, and she looks so different. Like, life had really worn her down. And it's like, yeah, there's so much to just extrapolate just from looking into this woman's eyes. It's so fascinating. So Emrata ends the essay by saying, eventually, Jonathan will run out of unseen, crusty Polaroids, but I will remain as the real Emily, the Emily who owns the high art Emily, and the one who wrote this essay too. She will continue to carve out control where she can find it. I thought that was really nice. Honestly, I really respected the article. I thought it was really well written.
It's a rare kind of glimpse into, you know, what is a very specific experience, which is being
Emily Ratajkowski.
Well, being an icon, being a model, but also being a model of that pedigree. But I do think that you, as a woman, can also, like, relate to the kind of eternal back and forth between, like, woman as the muse, woman as an autonomous being, women in relation to art, and how you see
being a woman on the internet.
Yeah, like, you know, I think it's a very cool, interesting piece, and I think
it's an oddly universal piece.
Yeah, we often roll our eyes at girls who we think have the fortune of looking like Emily Ratajkowski. I don't know, it just goes back to the whole like idea of pretty privilege.
There's like a few things I hate more than that term.
Well, like, yeah, and it's just like our ability to kind of erase the fact that she too is a woman and is experiencing the hardships of what it means to be a fucking woman.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I don't know, just to end off, like, photography has always had these issues, and Instagram is just another facet of all these tensions. The question is just how much further it'll exacerbate them. Rehash is hosted by Hannah Rain and me, Maia. It's produced and edited by me, and the intro and outro song is produced by our talented friend, Ian Mills. Thanks for listening.